Late afternoon was taking on the complexion of dusk. The sun's rays slanted low through the high grass, and the temperature began to drop from the infernal to the merely intolerable. A gusty breeze made a constant play of swirls and ripples in the Kogan, as though a distracted artist were beginning whimsical thoughts and ending them abruptly. As they snapped through the coarse grass, the men's collective mood was one of buoyant and almost carefree adolescence. They joked and jibed with one another. They boasted about how many Japs they would kill. They toted their weapons like toys. The gathering zeal of the march, it seemed, had momentarily suppressed their sense of the mission's gravity. As one ranger described it, they could have been bounding off to a rugby match. After a half mile, the tall grass fields turned into rice paddies, a quilt of blonde stalks and black mud stretching to the highway. The men adjusted their gazes. All conversation, all joking, stopped. They squinted and shielded their eyes with cupped hands to break the glare. There it stood, a tattered city of thatch and razor wire swimming in the heat waves. The view was hazy but unobstructed, a straight shot south. The rangers were startled and at the same time a little relieved to lay eyes, finally, on the target after 3 days of thinking about little else, to affix an image to the strange word they'd been uttering since Musi first announced the mission. Cabanatuan. The camp was imposing in size and appeared to be well guarded. But even from their safe remove, the rangers could see that it was no impregnable citadel. The enclosure enjoyed no height advantages, no defensive works, no intervening obstacles of water. Rising only slightly above the vegetational haze, the compound consisted merely of barbed wire stretched taut across a field, with wooden towers studding the corners. In an ordinary strategic sense, taking it should pose no insurmountable problems. What made the target so intimidating was its emphatic isolation. Cabanatuan was a world unto itself, standing alone, a civilizational cyst. Nothing else broke the horizon for miles in any direction. Nothing but the one nipa shack in which Nellist and Vakilar had been crouched all afternoon. Musi and Prince surveyed the terrain with worried looks spreading over their faces. Trained to capitalize on the asset of surprise, rangers instinctively shied away from open ground such as this. Considering how well-armed his men were, Musi might have been willing to risk forfeiting surprise in this case, were he not also forced to consider the hair-trigger delicacy of the situation inside. One tiny mistake, he recognized, could provoke the very outcome they were trying to prevent, a slaughtering of prisoners. Prince gave the signal, and the men stepped forward, crouching in silence. They fanned out over the rice quadrants in broad waves of 30 men. Their boots crumped over the hard, cracked floors of the paddies, scattering flocks of field birds and reedy insects. Rice stalks rustled in a fickle breeze. The men were silent but for the random clicks and rattles of their weapons, the low friction of canvas rubbing canvas. After 100 yards of stooped marching, Prince gave another hand gesture, this one a signal to the men of F Company, releasing them on their separate errand. According to the plan, one platoon from F Company, 30 men in all, would break off from Prince's main group and, after describing a wide arc around the eastern perimeter, would assume attack positions in the rear of the camp. They had the longest way to go, and would thus need more time to reach their destination than Prince's C Company would. The rear of the camp was more than 800 yards away from the main gate, and impossible to see from the front of the enclosure, so Prince would have no way of knowing when F Company had arrived at its position. All of which explained why Prince had decided that F Company should initiate the raid by firing the first volley. The men of F Company's 2nd platoon were led by a young lieutenant from Springfield, Massachusetts, named John Murphy. A sinewy man with a bony face and lugubrious, deep-set eyes, Murph, as nearly everyone called him, had graduated from Notre Dame and wanted to pursue a career in politics after the war. He was a cautious, understated leader in whom Musi and Prince had implicit confidence. Prince glanced over at Murphy and with a crisp wave sent the men of F Company on their way. Prince figured Murphy's group would need about an hour to skulk around to the back of the camp. If all went according to plan, the next sign of F Company would be the deafening report of their weapons firing on the rear guard towers, the unmistakable Philip that would set everything in motion.